Hello there, and thank you for listening to this Pro Bono Students Canada podcast. Before the show starts, I'd like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they're not authorized to provide any legal advice. This podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and legally related issues. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. With that in mind, let's dive into the case of Nevsun Resources Limited v. Araya, and how its ruling may be understood as having quietly, but meaningfully, shifted how Canadian courts approach international law. Nevsun is a Canadian-owned mining company who are being accused in a Canadian court of human rights abuses that they committed in the course of their operations abroad. How does a Canadian court approach this? When courts are asked to confront allegations of international human rights abuses, the instinct is often to ask a moral question. What happened? Who was harmed? Who should be held responsible? And perhaps even, how should they be held responsible? But before any of these questions can be answered, there's a quieter and more technical question that must come first. How does international law operate when it appears in a Canadian courtroom? Is it something that has to be proven, like a fact? Or is it something that can be recognized and applied, like domestic law? That process and evidentiary question, often invisible to non-lawyers, sits at the very top and at the very core of the Nevsun case. How the Supreme Court answered it may matter just as much as anything it said about corporate accountability or human rights. The factual allegations and their context. To understand why Nevsun ever made its way to a Canadian courtroom, it's necessary to say a bit about the country of Eritrea and the economic and political environment in which this litigation arose. Nevsun Resources operated a gold mine in Eritrea, the Bisha mine, which by the late 2010s had become one of the most economically significant industrial projects in the country. According to Eritrean economic reporting, the Bisha mine alone contributed close to 20% of Eritrea's total GDP. In a state with very few major revenue sources, this mine was not peripheral, it was central. That economic reality matters, because Eritrea is widely understood to be a totalitarian state. Political dissent is suppressed, independently courts are effectively non-existent, and the population lives under a constant surveillance and fear of government reprisal. Many Eritreans live in deep poverty, and the state maintains control not only through law, but through coercion and enforced dependency. Central to that system is Eritrea's National Service Program. On paper, it resembles compulsory service. In practice, it's been described by international observers as a system of indefinite forced labor. Eritreans are automatically enlisted when they turn 18 and assigned to whatever work the state chooses for them. The government does not meaningfully consider a person's skills, preferences, or safety. Individuals may be sent to factories, sanitation work, construction, or agriculture labor. Others may be forced to continue schooling, not as an opportunity, but as an obligation, training to become doctors, judges, or administrators for the state. Crucially, the people placed into positions of authority, police officers, judges, supervisors, are often those the state believes it can most easily manipulate or coerce. Power is distributed not based on merit, but on control. It was within this system that Nevsun's mining operations were carried out in the early 2010s. According to the plaintiffs, who were laborers at the Bisha mine, they were drawn directly from the National Service Program. These workers allegedly labored 12 hours a day for 6 days a week, with that seventh day of the week being a six-hour workday. All of this work being done in the extreme heat of an Eritrean desert. The allegations concerning working conditions were severe. Workers who were late, disobedient, or who attempted to escape were allegedly hogtied, beaten, and forced to roll naked in the sand as punishment. These allegations did not come from a single source, but from a collective of Eritrean refugees who later escaped to Ethiopia, Sudan, England, and Germany. Using these accounts, a Canadian human rights law firm brought the case to a British Columbia court, alleging that a Canadian company had benefited from slave labor and other grave human rights abuses. This context explains something critical about Nevsun. This litigation did not arise because Canadian courts were eager to police the world. It arose because no other forum was realistically available. Without mechanisms of transnational justice, without the willingness of domestic courts to hear claims connected to their own corporations, atrocities such as forced labor, torture, or even murder, when economically beneficial to foreign enterprises, may never be heard at all. And if unheard, they're almost certainly unpunished. This is the policy backdrop against which the Supreme Court's procedural and evidentiary choices must be understood. This brings us to a deeper policy concern about Nevsun. If Canadian corporations are permitted to structure their operations so that the most coercive and abusive conduct occurs just beyond Canada's borders, insulated by a foreign state with weak or non-existent legal systems, then corporate accountability becomes optional. The plaintiff's argument was not that Canadian law should replace Eritrean law. It's that Canadian corporations should not be governed solely by the law of states that systematically violate human rights. Despite that being the argument, that's not what the courts were being asked to determine. So what was it? It's crucial to understand what Nevsun was and was not about. At the Supreme Court, there was no trial. There's no findings of fact. There's no credibility assessments. Nevsun brought a motion to strike. They argued that the plaintiff's claims should be dismissed at the outset. The applicable test was whether it was plain and obvious that the claim had no reasonable chance of success. But embedded within that procedural posture was a deeper issue, one with significant policy implications. How should Canadian courts approach international law when it's pleaded as a part of a civil claim? That question affects not only outcomes, but also how counsel frames their arguments, how judges reason through disputes, and what courts consider themselves entitled to know without proof. In Canadian courts, foreign law, meaning the domestic law of another sovereign state, is treated as a fact. If a party wishes to rely on it, it must be proven, typically through expert evidence, and it's subject to evidentiary rules and cross-examination. International law has, at times, been treated in a similar manner. The majority of the Supreme Court in Nevsun pushes firmly in the opposite direction. The majority held that public international law, including treaties and customary international law, should generally be treated as law, not fact, for the purposes of Canadian adjudication. That distinction matters enormously. If something is treated as fact, it must be proven through evidence. It becomes subject to admissibility rules, and it may be challenged through cross-examination. If something is treated as law, courts may take judicial notice of it. No formal proof is required, and counsel will argue it's an authority, not testimony. For the Nevsun case, the claims brought forth through international law were to belong in this second category. They were to be treated as law. The decision written by Justice Abella focused specifically on customary international law, or CIL. Before turning to customary international law, it helps to situate it within the broader architecture of international law. Unlike treaties, which bind states only when they've been formally consented, or general principles and judicial decisions, which operate more as interpretive guides. Customary international law emerges from what states actually do, and from their shared understanding of what they are legally required to do. The court reaffirmed a long-standing principle of Canadian law. Established norms of customary international law are automatically incorporated into Canadian common law, unless they conflict with legislation. This means that norms such as the prohibition of slavery, the prohibition of forced labor, and the prohibition of torture are not foreign imports or aspirational ideals. They are already a part of the legal framework within which Canadian courts operate. And because they are law, courts are entitled and required to judicially notice them. No expert evidence is required to prove that torture is prohibited. No witness is needed to establish that forced labor violates international law. These are legal premises, not factual assertions. This is one of Nevsun's most understated yet consequential contributions. By treating established customary international law as law rather than fact, the court does three very important things for future human rights claims. It simplifies how these claims may be pleaded. It clarifies how counsel should present international norms. And it reduces procedural barriers that might otherwise prevent claims from ever being heard. International law no longer needs to arrive in Canadian courts disguised as expert opinion. It can arrive openly, cited, interpreted, and debated as law. This does not mean that every international claim will succeed. It just means that courts no longer assume they're incapable of knowing the law of the international community. From a policy perspective, this reflects a judicial willingness to engage with globalization rather than retreat from it. In this case, the majority and the dissent did have competing institutional concerns. The majority reasons, which were authored by Justice Abella, emphasized access to justice and doctrinal coherence as its underlying principles. The majority expressed concerns that treating established international norms as matters requiring proof would create unnecessary procedural barriers and risk insulating serious allegations from judicial scrutiny altogether. By contrast, the dissenting judges, Justice Brown, Roe, and Cote, raised institutional and separation of powers concerns. They warned that allowing novel international law claims to proceed could create uncertainty for Canadian businesses, improperly expand the role of courts, and draw the judiciary into matters better left to legislatures or international bodies. Importantly, the dissent did not deny the existence of customary international law. Rather, it cautioned against courts moving too quickly in recognizing new causes of action grounded in it. Crucially, for both the majority and the dissent, the Nevsun decision does not suggest that all international law must always be judicially noticed. The court acknowledged a potential exception for new or novel claims of customary international law. These cases may include emerging norms, contested or controversial rules, or alleged obligations lacking settled recognition. In such cases, courts may appropriately require evidence of state practice, often through expert testimony, subject to the usual rules of admissibility. This preserves flexibility and restraint. It allows courts to distinguish between well-established norms requiring no proof and genuinely contested claims that demand evidentiary grounding. The result is not doctrinal recklessness, but procedural discipline. Why does this matter, then, beyond Nevsun? Nevsun is often discussed as a case about corporate accountability, and it is that. But it's also a case about judicial confidence. Confidence that Canadian courts can identify established international norms, treat them as law, and apply them without pretending that they're foreign facts, requiring some sort of translation. This shift affects how international law enters domestic litigation, not only in human rights cases, but potentially in areas such as environmental harm, armed conflict, and transnational corporate conduct. It reshapes pleadings, it reshapes advocacy, and it reshapes what courts are willing to say that they already know. The three Eritrean plaintiffs achieved a significant procedural and doctrinal victory when the ruling in February 2020 dismissed Nevsun's motion to strike claim. It was not plain and obvious that the plaintiff's claim, including those grounded in customary international law, had no reasonable prospect of success. The outcome ensured that the plaintiffs would have the opportunity to present evidence and advance their claims in a full trial setting in British Columbia. In principle, Canadian courts were ready to adjudicate civil law claims, alleging serious human rights violations committed abroad and linked to a Canadian corporation. A private-to-private matter, which occurred in Eritrea, to be tried in a BC court. How interesting. Unfortunately, interesting for us, with this case, kind of stops here. The parties did not proceed to trial. In October 2020, Nevsun Resources and the plaintiffs reached a confidential, out-of-court settlement. While the terms of that settlement were, of course, not disclosed, the resolution brought the litigation to a close and avoided a judicial determination on the merits. The principle of the Supreme Court decision remains, though. Nevsun does not guarantee justice. It does not eliminate legal hurdles, and it does not transform Canadian courts into global tribunals. But it does do something quieter, and perhaps more enduring. It tells us that international law is not something that Canadian courts must be convinced exists. It's something that they already are entitled to recognize. And once a court accepts that, once it's acknowledged that some norms are so fundamental that they require no proof, the law's imagination expands. Not recklessly, but deliberately. Before we end the show, I'd like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and legally related issues. If you require legal advice, please consult a lawyer. Thank you for listening.
If you're anything like me several months ago, you may have never heard of civil forfeiture. Maybe you've watched John Oliver's viral critique, which sparked public debate about the issue. In this episode, we'll explore what civil forfeiture is, how it operates in Canada, and some of the key arguments both for and against its use. Good morning, and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Geffen Spill. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aims to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is on civil forfeiture. This is a topic I came across earlier this year during my first year in law school, and one I could not stop learning more about. So what is civil forfeiture? Well, let's start with its foundation. Before we start the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. This podcast contains general discussions of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. Most crime is motivated by profit. That's what politicians across Canada, the UK, and other jurisdictions seem to think. They propose giving provincial governments the power to seize private property from people through a civil proceeding without them having to be convicted of a crime. You might be more familiar with criminal forfeiture. As part of the sentencing process, the Crown can move to seize your assets if there is a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. These are called in personam proceedings because it is the accused that is on trial. On the other hand, civil forfeiture takes us out of the world of criminal law, into civil proceedings where the government can bring an action against the private property itself, and seize it if they can show on a balance of probabilities that it was involved in, or is the proceed of, a crime. Now, it is possible you're already thinking about the pros and cons of such a policy. On the one hand, you may be thinking about how this helps governments fight crime. On the other hand, you may be thinking of some of the potential constitutional and due process concerns that arise from enacting such a statute in Canada. My research led me to ask the following question. Does the current Canadian civil forfeiture scheme appropriately balance crime deterrence and individual rights so that its efficacy justifies possible intrusions on those rights? Academics on this topic have seemingly identified a sort of two-pronged problem that animates the civil forfeiture debate. First, per some critics, civil forfeiture has the potential to interfere with the principles of due process and infringe on the rights of property owners to the enjoyment of their property, with limited protections for innocent parties. Second, the efficacy of civil forfeiture in achieving its objectives of crime deterrence may be unclear and difficult to measure. So what's in store for you throughout this podcast to help you understand where these conclusions come from? First, we will examine the policy rationales that proponents of civil forfeiture rely on to justify its use. Second, we will examine the criticisms surrounding due process concerns and property rights. Finally, we will examine whether civil forfeiture has actually been successful in achieving its goal. Before we get into all that, I want to clarify again that this podcast is an effort to gather information regarding both sides of the debate and present you, the listener, with as much information as possible to decide where you stand. So let's start with the policy rationales. Jeffrey Simser, an expert on the topic, has published extensively on civil forfeiture and has outlined some of these rationales in his work. Of course, the primary goal of civil forfeiture is deterrence, and it seems rational that crime is motivated by profit. This is grounded in the belief that property obtained through unlawful activity should not be held by and accumulate in the hands of people who commit unlawful activity. Since profit is often the motivating factor behind unlawful activity, a lower standard for the forfeiture of the profits and instruments of crime will make prospective wrongdoers think twice before breaking the law. One of the most interesting supports for the use of civil forfeiture and the lower standard of proof is combating organized crime, specifically the goal being to bring the leaders of organized crime to justice. Leaders of organized crime protect themselves by having foot soldiers carry out incriminating tasks, allowing them to enjoy the profits of crime without the threat of conviction-based forfeiture. Civil forfeiture, on the other hand, allows governments to go after the profits and avoid the barriers to conviction that these organized crime leaders create for themselves. So, I don't know about you, but some of these rationales do sound promising to me. So why is there a debate about the topic? This brings us to our next segment, the criticisms of civil forfeiture. Many scholars, including Michelle Gallant and Colin King, have delved into some of the negative consequences that these laws have. I'll be focusing on two of them today and examining some case law: the harms to due process and the concerns over the property rights of individuals. Let's start with due process. At the heart of this concern is the difference between the criminal beyond a reasonable doubt standard and the civil balance of probability standard. Aaron Felmeth makes this concern pretty clear, stating that the result is to ensure the efficient control of private behavior without the need to honor such pesky rights as the guarantees against double jeopardy and excessive fines, and most importantly, the requirement that the state prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. So what do his concerns really look like in practice? The application of the lower standard may interfere with due process in several ways. First, the Crown may easily prove its case with evidence that would be insufficient in a criminal proceeding. This includes the opinion evidence of experts or law enforcement that could not, on their own, satisfy the beyond a reasonable doubt requirement. Also, since civil forfeiture proceedings occur separately from the criminal ones, the seizing of property under the civil proceeding may undermine acquittals from criminal trials in previous proceedings. Picture this. An accused is acquitted for a drug offense in a criminal trial, but the government then seizes his house or his car through civil forfeiture. Will society still view him as innocent? Canadian courts have actually commented on this concern, with Justice Corbett in Ontario v. Cole Watson holding that an in personam judgment that binds the Crown conclusively decides the in rem question. What he's essentially saying here is that the criminal proceeding decides the civil proceeding, and that the courts have the tools to prevent the government from seizing property through civil forfeiture after an acquittal has been issued in the criminal trial, holding that the acquittal will not be undermined because of those tools. This case was actually cited by the Supreme Court in Chatterjee, which is the only civil forfeiture case to make it to the Supreme Court. The court stated that res judicata, the doctrine that prevents the relitigation of matters already decided by the court, along with other tools, were all arguments available to property owners to challenge civil proceedings that follow criminal acquittals. It seems that the judges recognized a due process issue with the administration of the Civil Remedies Act when criminal forfeiture acquittal was previously issued, but concluded that this is a matter that can be addressed by the courts, as it was in Cole Watson. With Canadian courts seemingly satisfied that the due process critiques of civil forfeiture may be adequately addressed through legal tools, let's examine the concerns over property rights of individuals. Before examining the property rights concerns, it is important to note that Canada actually does not have constitutionally protected property rights, while the US does. This limits the ability of critics of civil forfeiture or property owners who have had their property seized to challenge that decision on constitutional grounds. Even though this is the case, it is still worthwhile to examine some of the property rights concerns. First, forfeiture may take away from the property rights of innocent parties, including joint tenants, business partners, lien holders, or buyers who purchased the property without knowledge of its use in unlawful activity or its origins from such activity. The Supreme Court actually held that there is no need for proof that a property owner themselves committed a crime. They provided the following example, which I find pretty helpful. A drug dealer may gift the proceeds of a drug sale to charity, and that money may be the subject of civil forfeiture, even after the charity becomes its owner. However, it is also important to note that there are some measures in civil forfeiture legislation to protect innocent parties. The Ontario legislation, for example, provides that where a property owner can prove that they are an uninvolved interest holder in the property, the court can make orders to protect their interests. Another concern is that even if a party is not completely innocent of the offense, there may be disproportionate impact on the accused and their family if their home or other important property is seized. This concerns critics, especially when they consider that the balance of probabilities is a low bar to create this potentially devastating impact on the life of the accused. Think smaller crimes leading to very large punishments. Okay. So we've covered a lot so far. We've heard about the pros of civil forfeiture, and we've just now discussed briefly some of the cons. Now the real question is, do the ends justify the means? Does civil forfeiture sufficiently achieve crime deterrence and reduce criminal profits to justify these negative impacts? The answer is, we don't really know. R.T. Naylor argues that it is very difficult to measure the efficacy of civil forfeiture in deterring crime, making it difficult to justify in light of the negative consequences. First, there are no clear criteria to measure the success of civil forfeiture. The metric of total seized assets by police, which is often cited as a metric for the success of civil forfeiture, is sometimes used to misrepresent the success of the legislation, which in reality is not a true reflection. Naylor argues that the increase in assets seized by police does not lead to the conclusion that there is less criminal activity, because the total criminal economy may continue to expand. Further, seized assets are not the objective to be measured, but rather they are the tool that the government claims deters crime in the first place. Only the input of seized assets is evident in that figure, not the output of reduced crime. Reduced crime is the objective, and total seized assets just does not reflect that. Naylor also argues that the psychology of crime is more complex than something that is just motivated by profits. The view that criminals are only motivated by profits is an oversimplification of criminal motivation, according to him. Criminal motivation is a complex mix of psychological, social, and economic factors. So even if we could find that civil forfeiture makes crime less profitable. That does not necessarily mean it will deter it. So where does that leave us, the listeners? Is civil forfeiture justified? This is a difficult question to answer without proof of its efficacy in deterring crime and making it less profitable. Many are concerned with the negative consequences of these laws, and that concern makes sense. I mean, the idea that governments have powers to essentially execute criminal law objectives through civil proceedings does go against our traditional view of due process. However, the Supreme Court did hold that Ontario's statute is constitutional, despite arguments that it touches on the federal government's criminal law powers. So it is possible that the due process issue and concern of critics is actually settled from a legal perspective. On the other hand, administering civil forfeiture law cases while balancing due process may be difficult to do in practice, especially since social stigma does not always respect the distinctions between cases against an individual accused and cases against their property. Maybe we can strike a balance between the two sides of the argument if there are more robust protections for innocent party owners in the legislation and some guardrails to prevent the seizing of essential property, such as someone's home, for less serious offenses. This is a debate that has spanned decades and will likely continue to animate discussions about criminal deterrence and individual rights. I hope this episode gave you a glimpse into a topic that I find fascinating and has given you a foundation to decide where you stand on the issue. I'm your host, Geffen Spill. If you like this episode, you could find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website. Thank you for listening.
Hello, and welcome to Pro Bono Radio. My name is Gilad Mayansky, and I will be the host of today's episode. Summer jobs. We've all had them, from July spent scooping ice cream to August spent showing off the latest big summer blowout sales. The summer job is a seminal part of your late teen years and young adulthood, representing the steady increase of responsibility you receive as you exit your childhood years. However, during this transition, the demands a person is expected to take on often involve a heightened level of caution or care. For me, this manifested in my employment as a summer camp counselor. Despite having no prior experience taking care of children, I found myself responsible for the supervision and safety of over 60 14 to 15-year-olds. Over the course of 6 weeks, I took on a duty that was far more consequential than any previous position I had held. This brings me to the subject of today's episode. What is this duty? Despite only being a young adult, many of the summer jobs you have will entail a higher duty of responsibility. Have you ever wondered what that duty is? What are you personally liable for? Summer jobs are merely a stepping stone on the way to full workplace responsibility and accountability. So I'd like to help unpack this question through the lens of tort law by explaining the concept of duty of care, standard of care, and foreseeability. To explore this today, I will be talking with Heidi Brown, a personal injury lawyer and a partner at Bogorock & Associates LLP. Before starting at Bogorock's, Heidi spent 7 years as a counsel to the Children's Lawyer Ministry of the Attorney General for the Province of Ontario, where she represented the legal interests of children in various litigation matters. Based on my experiences as a camp counselor, I will pose a series of hypothetical but realistic issues that can emerge over the duration of a summer to help define what this duty is. We will start with the duty of a mere counselor before working our way through examples of heightened duties to help clear up what these important concepts are. Through our conversation, I hope to clarify what duty and standard of care you owe at your summer job. Hi, Heidi. Thank you so much for joining us today. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, Gilad. Thank you so much for having me. I am a personal injury lawyer, and I was called to the bar in 1993. So I've been doing this for quite some time, over 30 years now. I am a partner at the law firm of Bogorosh & Associates LLP in Toronto, where we practice exclusively personal injury and medical malpractice litigation. We also handle some complex occupiers liability matters, slip and falls, injuries from products, and we do various degrees of injury, but all on the plaintiff side. We do not do any defense work. For the first 7 years of my career, I worked for the Ministry of the Attorney General in an office called the Office of the Children's Lawyer, where I exclusively practiced law for children. And since 1999, I have been practicing in private practice with Bogarash and Associates. And it's a very fulfilling, rewarding career, which I don't know if any of your listeners are considering, but would be more than happy to share the aspects of that with anyone who's interested.
That's awesome. I'm thrilled to get to speak with you today. And so I just wanted to introduce a few hypotheticals so that we can help sort of explain the tort liability duty of care that one could encounter at a summer position, such as a summer camp counselor. So the first hypothetical I'd like to introduce is a pretty standard one, one that could happen pretty frequently or easily. A 10-year-old child is playing soccer at a summer camp with direct exposure to the sun under the supervision of a counselor. Due to the heat, the exercise, and the direct exposure of the sunlight, they pass out due to heat exhaustion and dehydration. From a legal perspective, how would you analyze the staff's responsibility in that situation? Should they have been supervised more cautiously, cautioned about a hat, bringing a water bottle, for example?
So I appreciate and thank you for the question. It's a very broad topic and one I could probably speak about for a week. But if we try to zero in and narrow down the specific question, we're talking about the liability of summer camps and staff at summer camps and the specific issue of heat stroke and dehydration in children, which are both very common in the summer and can lead to children becoming very seriously ill. Dehydration and heat stroke can, in some cases, lead to very long-lasting serious impacts for children. And there are two different things, dehydration and heat stroke, but in the most severe cases of heat stroke, when the body's core temperature is usually defined as being above 40 degrees Celsius, the body can't cool itself through sweating and can lead to serious conditions like seizures, brain damage, organ failure, coma, and worst case, even death. So the issue of proper supervision and monitoring children on a hot day at a summer camp is a very important one, and one that we might see as questions coming from the public to our office inquiring as to whether or not there might be a case arising from such a scenario. So the first thing that sort of to start at very basic premise is that almost everyone owes someone else a duty of reasonable care to avoid injuring someone else. Different professionals might owe a higher standard or degree of care depending on their professional experience and qualifications. But people in certain contexts, certainly in a camping context, owe those that are in their charge, that are paying for being kept safe, owe them a duty to keep them safe. The first thing to be aware of in a camping setting, which is very similar to a school setting in many respects, is that whoever is supervising a camper functions in the place of the parent. We call it in Latin in loco parentis. So a teacher or a counselor or a camp director is really acting in the place of the parent when they're looking for a child. And under common law, camp counselors and their supervisors owe a duty to these young participants in the summer camp that is similar, comparable to that of a careful, reasonably prudent, careful parent. So we look in the common law at the reasonable standard based on what a parent would do. But we also, in Ontario and in most provinces in Canada, we have statutory provisions that govern how to keep people safe. So we in Ontario have a statute called the Occupiers Liability Act. And under that act, camps owe a duty to take reasonable care to keep campers and staff, every visitors, anybody who's on the premises safe, to maintain safe premises, to supervise adequately, and to train staff properly in a reasonable way. And remember the word reasonable, because we're going to come back to it later, I expect. It's not a standard of perfection. It's a standard of reasonableness. What would an objective person deem to be a reasonable standard? It's not a standard of perfection. So with regard to dehydration and heat exhaustion, heat stroke specifically, I would argue that the camp's duty to take reasonable care, their duty to their campers and the parents by extension, includes certain things like training and vetting staff who will be working with the children to institute safe staff-to-camper ratios, to teach the staff how to spot the first signs of heat illness, to train staff in first aid, CPR, to make reasonable efforts to monitor children to ensure they're engaged in safe play, to check the weather conditions every day and Environment Canada's heat alerts, give children cool places to play on hot days, playing in the shade if they're going to play, making sure there's frequent water breaks and monitoring the amount of fluids the children are drinking, taking in, and adjusting or canceling outdoor activities during a heat wave if it mandates, the situation mandates it. So it's been a long answer to a question, but the gist is that if a child gets sick from the heat at camp, and these rules that I sort of just outlined that I would consider as a lawyer to be reasonable weren't followed, the staff could well be found liable, and the camp can be called vicariously liable, which is they step in the shoes of the staff. They're the employees. They're found liable. They're responsible for the negligence of their staff. And indeed, they could be exposed to a finding of liability in a lawsuit. I haven't even touched on the issue of foreseeability, which is a whole other issue, and I can certainly do that now if you'd like.
Yeah, well, I was just going to follow up with that. I thought it was a really interesting point when you discussed reasonableness, sort of as you don't have to behave perfectly, but you have to behave within a spectrum of what a reasonable person would do. And so, for example, within this hypothetical, we assume it's a normal child without any prior medical conditions. But in an additional hypothetical, let's say that this child perhaps has a medical condition that makes their low blood sugars, some form of asthma, something that might make this issue even worse, more dangerous, a medical condition that might make the situation more threatening. Would that play into this spectrum? Like how perfect does the staff have to act if there's sort of an additional burden placed on the child?
Good question. So let me just briefly touch on the notion of foreseeability. It is a very in-depth topic. The Supreme Court of Canada has written on it extensively, and there are entire tort law courses that are devoted specifically to the issue of foreseeability. But to try and keep it as simple as possible, in Canadian tort law, a duty of care requires a relationship of sufficient proximity, which means an analysis of both reasonable foreseeability and proximity. So in general, how do I say it? Someone owes a duty of care to those whom reasonably to have in contemplation of being at risk when they act or they fail to act. And it's, as we talked about before, it's to be determined objectively. What would have been known by someone with the potential defendant's knowledge and experience? And you can't base it on hindsight, for example, knowing, you know, after the fact that the harm has occurred. You have to look at determine it at the time of the alleged wrongdoing. So there have to be facts in evidence at the time of the alleged wrongdoing to find that someone reasonably should have foreseen risk of the type of harm that subsequently takes place to a person in the camper situation. So in the case where we have this added layer of the child having pre-existing medical conditions, most caregivers know how to look out for physical accidents, but many don't realize how dangerous heat exposure can be for young children who have underlying health conditions. And most camps, most good camps, require that parents will complete a medical form for their children to be provided well in advance of the session to alert the camp of any medical conditions that the child has, like allergies to food or insect bites or what types of medication they need to be on. And the ones I think that you just cited are this particular child in this fact pattern has asthma or potentially low blood sugar or something like that, which in and of itself could contribute to a much worse situation of this dehydration or heat exposure. So what does a camp do? What should a camp do to fulfill their duty of care? And I find that most good camps have instituted their own policies to optimize the care that they provide. So what would those be? Having trained medical personnel meet with the staff to provide them with information about the child's special needs before the kids come to camp. And having those medical special, a doctor, a nurse, a trained paramedic on site to be aware of those specific medical conditions and treat them in the event that a situation arises, to have schedules, designated times, checklists for medication administration and things like that. So this standard is one of reasonableness. Children can fall ill even in the care of their own parents. So the test becomes what is reasonable in any given set of circumstances on an objective standard. Going back to what I said earlier, if you have a camp doctor or a nurse or a paramedic who didn't do something in keeping with their professional standard of care, so let's say they didn't administer the proper medication, or they didn't administer any medication, or they failed to meet their professional standards, that could even qualify as a medical malpractice, which is separate and distinct from a breach of standard in tort or under the statutory regime of occupier's liability. So it's opening up the camp not only to a lawsuit in tort under the Occupiers Liability Act, but also potentially to a medical malpractice case if there are medical personnel there who have that training and didn't live up to their duty. So if a child shows obvious signs of heat stroke and the trained nurse or doctor doesn't recognize that and gives improper treatment, delays getting emergency vehicle involved, parents may very well be within their right to pursue a medical negligence claim as well. Now, I've worked at a summer camp. My children have attended summer camp. And we all know that sometimes parents don't fully do what they're supposed to do and live up to their end of the bargain. And if they don't fully disclose a child's complete health history on the medical form, the parents are potentially muddying the waters and opening themselves up to a finding of contributory negligence if a lawsuit is to be initiated by the parents. I would argue that the parents have an obligation to make sure that anyone that they are entrusting their children to for any length of time are fully aware of a child's underlying health conditions. And it really does depend on the degree of experience. An 18 or 19-year-old counselor who doesn't have a lot of medical training is not going to be held to the same standard as a trained professional. And if you, none of you know that the children have asthma, it's pretty hard, unless you're a trained person who's able to spot that just by asking the right questions or doing an examination, it's going to be very difficult to hold them to a standard of negligence in those situations. So, in spite of all the safety measures in place, precautions, training, care, accidents can still happen. But the key is if you took reasonable care to keep the kids safe and help them when they were hurt, you're insulating yourself from liability.
I find that really interesting where you talk about sort of the insulation the higher ups in the camp have to provide in this situation, like as much protection from liability as possible. For example, when you were transporting the child out of the summer camp, perhaps the injuries have been exacerbated to a certain point. They now need medical treatment at a hospital. I'm kind of interested in exploring foreseeability here. If on the way to the hospital, the ambulance has to swerve off the road, there's some major incident along the way, and the ambulance swerves off the road, leading to further harm for this child, would this be a foreseeable outcome that the camp would have to react to, have to form some sort of protection against? How foreseeable does the summer camp and the board of directors have to act within that?
Well, you're sort of getting into an area that that takes you outside the liability of the camp. And we operate on a premise that you can only be held responsible. A person can only be held liable or responsible for a breach of a duty of care that causes certain damage that must be linked to that breach of duty. So in the example that we've talked about, child has heat stroke, they're not feeling well. If they fully recover and there is really not going to be any longstanding health implications for this child, the damages aspect is going to be very low, right? So you know, it's not likely that you're going to, if you're a parent, go ahead and sue the camp if hopefully, which is what everybody hopes, the outcome is good, the child makes great recovery and They're no worse for wear, and they feel better in a few hours. You know, you don't go to court and you don't bring a lawsuit unless it's going to have a corresponding financial level of compensation that's going to make it worthwhile. There are other remedies, by the way, besides lawsuits that parents have at their disposal to consider if financial compensation isn't the only thing that they're after. So you can also make a report to a provincial licensing authority. Let's say the camp is licensed by a specific ministry and you want to make a complaint to that provincial ministry or a public health department or even a child protection service. They are required to investigate any types of complaints that they receive, and perhaps the camp could end up losing its license. It's not a compensatory thing, but it's a remedy that could have very negative and serious results for the camp. There's also potential human rights remedies that are available. You can file a human rights complaint if you're a parent under, certainly for Ontario, which is the province that I practice in, under territorial or provincial human rights legislation, if a child's disability was ignored for some reason, which led to more exposure to heat or delayed care or something like that, you can also make a complaint, which is a different type of remedy. It sort of is a more like a peace of mind type of remedy. So there are a whole host of different things that you can look at here in the context of this. But once the child's in the ambulance, if the ambulance goes off the road and crashes and the child ends up with a broken leg or a brain injury that would not have flown from the original breach of the duty of the staff member not supervising or putting a hat on the child or giving them enough to drink or that sort of thing, the ambulance has a duty to ensure that they drive in keeping with the rules of the road. But if they're responsible for some additional harm to the child, you would be, as a lawyer, suing everybody. But you only typically are required to pay for the harm that you cause, right? So if camp caused maybe a little bit of heat stroke that would have gotten better, but ambulance caused broken leg and brain injury, ambulance is likely going to be on the hook for a lot more damages than the camp, if that makes sense. I realize we may be out of time, but I would be remiss if we didn't mention waivers in the context of camp, because in most cases, before a parent enrolls a child, most camps require parents or guardians to sign waivers that are designed to absolve the camp from any liability for injuries to children, and that the parents are accepting the risks, even in the case of negligent inaction or action on the part of the camp. And waivers are also a very interesting area of the law. They arise in any risky type of situation, on a ski hill, in a trampoline park. There's lots of interesting cases and decisions that talk about this. But what I wanted to just have your listeners know is that simply signing one of these waivers won't in and of itself necessarily disqualify a claim for compensation for damages. An effective waiver has to explicitly release the camp operator from liability. And usually they cannot escape what's called gross negligence in the case of a child. Courts do not like to see negligence involving children fall by the wayside. Any settlements for children need court approval of a judge. So as tight as these waivers are often written, courts might disregard them if the injury stems from gross negligence, and we can try and establish that there's some way of proving something that that the camp didn't do right by the child. So I really wanted to make sure that we covered that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for walking us through all the like duty of cares that might correspond at the same time, any of the different standard of care that arise. Yeah, I think for as broad as the questions may have been, I think you really helped illustrate all the different duties that could arise or the different obligations you owe the people that surround you. And so, yeah, thank you for explaining to us how as a summer camp, all of these responsibilities may arise, even from like the lowest level of just being the 17-year-old camp counselor taking care of children for the first time, all the way to a reckless ambulance driver. This has been Gilad Mayansky and Heidi Brown for Pro Bono Radio. Thank you all for joining us today.
The radio show that helps you relax and unwind after a busy day. Raccoon Radio Show with Gino Alash. Hard rock and heavy metal. Every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM, Kingston, Ontario, Canada. Stay heavy.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Combinations, a fully self-produced one-man band release from Plune. Written, performed, and produced entirely by the artist, the track blends the experimental spirit of Beck with a raw, stripped-down folk rock edge reminiscent of Neil Young. Learn more about the artist and keep up with the latest by following them at Plune Music on Instagram. And if you're a local musician who would like airplay and social media coverage on our channels, complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit at kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Combinations by Plune on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
How we see the world, which is that everybody is made up of lots and lots of different personalities, fantasies, attitudes, and that a multi-personality is in fact the reality, not the I personality, and that where those two things meet is the position that we're trying to work at, to break people across from seeing themselves as one-dimensional and having no potential, to seeing themselves as being almost anything they want to be, and that those different things don't have to always agree in the usual accepted way.
No Static, every Monday from 6 to 8 on CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. You never know what you're gonna get.
Monday.
Yeah.
When traffic's a nightmare. When the workplace is hectic. When your boss calls you in for a meeting. When nature isn't on your side. There's only one thing you can do.
But no need to wake up the neighbors. Tune in every Monday night from 11.